A podcast of the cinema.
Starring Alonzo Duralde. That's not me. That's you. You are the film editor of The Wrap.
Film reviews editor.
You're the film reviews editor of The Wrap. You're the co-host of Who Shot You on the Maximum Fun Network. You are the co-host of
Breakfast All Day.
That other one, Breakfast All Day, which is not on any network, just YouTube. And then there's me.
Dave White.
I'm Maud.
Who is not me. And then there's Maud. You are Dave White. You are a film critic for The Wrap and co-host of this program.
I'm also exhausted. Like,
well, it's been a week.
Listen, I've put my foot down. I'm putting my foot down, and I've decided that you're not going to that screening all the way over in Burbank later this afternoon.
Oh,
I've chosen that for you.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, because I want you home. So we can just have a nice dinner and everything be calm and nice and quiet.
Look, I'm not married to going to that screening.
This is not, that's right. You are married, unfortunately, to me. And that is, and I've decided what your fate is for this Friday evening.
Fine.
Did I say Friday evening?
I don't know.
Friday
what you said.
Evening.
This has been a weirdly guesty month for us. This podcast.
We've been packed with guests.
Manola Dargis was here.
Yes.
Johnny Jungle Guts was here to talk about Pokemon. Guinevere Turner.
Yes.
And now one of our favorite podcasters and dearest Seattleites, Matt Baum, is in town. Welcome,
Hello, sir.
Hello.
I am weirdly guesty and weirdly gusty.
Yes. Well,
thanks so much for
We'll leave
me.
A window open.
Explain,
thank you for being here.
Explain yourself, Matt.
What, oh, if, I've been no, trying for
what
years.
If nobody knows who you are? Won't do.
Hello, I'm Matthew Baum. I do a whole bunch of things for the internet. You may know me from my podcast, The Sewers of Paris, where I talk to LGBTQ people about the entertainment that has changed their lives. You've been frequent guests. Well, I don't know, frequent in as much as I've had you more than once.
Well, I appreciate it.
Been on
several
times.
You were early guests.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
true. Yes,
when you
that's
first
true.
Kicked it off.
And I was figuring it out.
There was one of us and then the other one of us. I don't remember what order, but.
And then you came back for the holidays and then you came back for a live stream. And
Well, that's right, because then there was the Palm Springsy thing and
oh right, yeah, you got us onto a panel once. And,
yeah,
you know, all so many
negligee, the National Gay and Lesbian Journalists Association.
That should be what they call it.
Is that what people call it?
Let's call it that. Yes,
I think
I
that's
like
what it.
It
should be called.
Yes,
I was hearing of a new acronym this week. Quilt bag. Do you know this one?
Oh yeah, I've heard of that. Yes.
Well, I have.
I can't
not.
Remember what it all stands.
Not
for.
Until this week have I heard of this acronym.
What does it stand for, Dave?
The S is for super. The U is for unique. The P is for perfection. And you know that we are freaks.
Stop right there.
The Q is for queer and questioning. Mm-hmm. The U is for...
This is as far as I can get.
Underdog. I don't know what the U is for.
Undeclared.
The I is for intersex. Uh-huh. L is for the lesbians. Mm-hmm. T is for trans.
B is for
the bis. A is for allied and asexual. Mm-hmm. And G is for the gays and the genderqueer.
Mm.
Covers everybody. And I told a friend yesterday who hates the word queer. He's like the one millennial I know who hates the word queer. And I told him this one, and he goes, "What do they all stand for?" And I tell him, and then he goes, "Nope." He goes, "First of all, allies don't get a letter."
That's true. What did they? Yeah.
like, why not?
Hey,
why
they're part they of the just, quilt bag community. Why not?
Listen, I have a big idiot heterosexual friend who performed our wedding in 1997.
Yes.
He gets his ally card.
Yes.
For that. He's a pain. but he gets it. Yeah. Also, I have knighted him with the power to tell homophobic jokes.
You really should not have that power.
I'm the ruler of my own gay kingdom, and so I decide which of my straight friends get to say the F word, and get to which ones get to call me. They get to call me the F word.
You are a subject in my gay kingdom.
They get to call me the F word. They don't get to say it out loud to the whole planet. They get to say it to me.
Fine.
And then they get to tell me homophobic jokes.
Matt, what brings you to Los Angeles?
Oh my goodness, quite a few things. So
let's see. I feel like I've been shut down.
So in addition to the Sewers of Paris, I have many other projects. I also have a YouTube series called Culture Cruise, where I talk about LGBT milestones on TV. So the gay episode of Maude, and the gay episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and the gay episode of The Simpsons, and all that kind of stuff.
Are you going on gayest episode ever while you're in town?
Already recorded.
Yay!
Yes.
Oh, excellent. Good.
Yeah. So listen for me on that. Also, I do a show called Queens of Adventure, featuring mm-hmm. drag queens playing Dungeons & Dragons.
Which I really love.
Thank you.
That you do this.
Has someone trademarked Dungeons & Drag Queens yet, or is that still floating around out there?
It is a great name for something. So great that a lot of people would like to use
okay,
it.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, good on you to move past the obvious joke. Yeah. I rarely do.
So let's see. So anyway, last weekend was a big Dungeons & Dragons event. It was D&D Live, The Descent. Where this is not going to mean anything to you guys, I assume, where they've announced that their next campaign setting is Avernus. Oh, my goodness.
I'm running to Twitter. I don't know what any of that means.
I don't know what that means either.
Now, here's the thing. If drag queens are playing D&D on a podcast.
Hold up. What does it mean?
Oh, well, it means that, yes. So this event is like, it's this delightful thing where they take a soundstage and they turn it into like a big LARPing arena, basically, where everyone's in costume and it looks like a set, like a fantasy set.
Oh, wow.
Games and all that stuff. And so Avernus is one of the nine circles of hell, or planes of hell. And so that means that we all get to go do our next adventures in hell. So they've released a whole bunch of stuff. And very interestingly, one of the new features that they're adding to Dungeons & Dragons, it's kind of like a software patch, basically, is they're doing a lot of stuff with like war machines now. So it's basically Mad Max in a tabletop setting. So you can play like these big vehicles that have like weird weapons and stuff on them.
Huh.
Yeah, it's very cool.
I haven't played since junior high, so I'm totally out of
those. I've never played it in my life.
But my question is, though, when you're doing a podcast that is drag queens playing D&D, do they bother to like make themselves up?
The magic of audio in Dungeons & Dragons in particular is the theater of the mind. Okay. We do live shows, and they are fully done up. When we have done live streams, they're fully done up for that. But in the same way that they are not actually casting magic spells, they're not fully judged at the
Fair
table.
Enough. I'm reminded of that line from Radio Days. He's a ventriloquist on the radio. How do you know his lips aren't moving?
So there's that last weekend, and then next weekend is, in just a few days, DragCon. So I'm going to be going to DragCon. It combines my two things.
Now, are you like paneling at DragCon or just attending?
Not this time. Last year we did a big like D&D session with Ben De La Creme and Kitty Powers and Erica Clash and Freya Love, and it was fabulous. And this year I'm like sitting back a little bit, just doing some, you know, networking with the drag queens, photographing the drag queens. We're planning our next big thing for Queens of Adventure, so no spoilers, but we've got some things in the works, and so.
And Queens of Adventure, is it mainly focused on like your local peeps, or do you like Sewers of Paris? Do you travel and do this with folks from different cities?
Yeah, we have different cities, so we're based in Seattle. We've done live shows in Seattle with some Seattle very talented performers. Mm-hmm. We've also got folks in San Francisco, Erica Clash and Poet Del Mar and Kai Kai B. Michael. And some other folks. And we've got some folks in Chicago that we're talking to now. Okay. And we've got some folks in other little pockets around the country. And we are working on establishing those casts so that we can do more shows closer to where people are. So if people want us to come to your city, do let us know. You can tweet at Dungeon Drag, and we have a Discord server, if you know what that means, where we are gathering our resources for that.
I've always admired your ability to build empires because, like, you know, you, like, had the whole YouTube thing down and then, you started podcasting and immediately sounded like NPR ready, whereas we've been doing this for, like, 9 years and we're still, like, So, you know, I doff my cap to you, sir.
Thank you. I doff my cap to you. Your shows are, like, talk about building an empire. Linoleum Knife is such a, like, it's expanding so marvelously with the family of products.
We're the new Beatrice.
We have a shampoo coming out.
Honestly, I would love it.
Pretty soon.
Linoleum knife shampoo. Yeah. I'm tempted.
There's beer in it, but don't drink it.
I need to talk about Boom before I forget.
Ooh, yes.
About Boom. All right, so here's what's up.
We haven't decided whether or not we actually gave an expiration date on this contest, but we're doing one now.
Hang on, you're jumping the gun here.
Well, I just want to be clear in case we did and we didn't.
In case people missed it, explain what this Blu-ray release is about and why it's the most important thing that is going to happen to your life in the year 2019.
Okay.
And so, I'm talking about all listeners to this show.
So Shout Select is doing 4 Blu-rays as part of their like Pride Month releases, and they are all very exciting releases. Coming out on Tuesday the 28th is To Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar, for the first time on Blu-ray. On June 14th, they are putting out Blu-ray debuts of Jeffrey, where I do a commentary track interviewing actor Steven Weber.
Oh.
And Can't Stop the Music, one of my favorite crazy-ass movies, with a commentary track featuring Bruce Valanche, who wrote several of the film's first drafts, and Jeffrey Schwartz, who directed the documentary The Fabulous Alan Carr, which I was lucky enough to be in. But also coming out on May 28th is, for the first time ever, the Joseph Losey film Boom, starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton.
Oh, yeah.
Screenplay by Tennessee Williams. It's John Waters' favorite movie. John Waters does a commentary track. And I am featured in the extras doing a whole thing about sort of the history of the film and the history of its kind of camp renaissance and whatnot.
It's like a nice little 15-20 minute chunk of you.
Yeah it's a lot of me, and they put my name on screen in the Boom font, which I can die now,
which is fantastic. They did not put makeup on your face though.
They didn't. This was a quick and dirty, but I'm hoping the informational content outweighs the shine on my nose. Anyway, so the Boom Blu-ray comes out on this Tuesday, May 28th, which I'm super excited about, and we're giving away a copy.
We are. We are doing this with my favorite form of contest.
The essay.
The essay contest, in which you write to us to tell us why you think this film is named Boom.
Yes.
Whether you know or not. And it doesn't even matter if you know.
The further away from the truth, the better.
The answer doesn't have to be accurate. The answer just has to entertain me. Not even Alonzo, me.
Yeah, no, I'm the staying
answer,
out of this one.
The answer has to entertain me. And then, in the same way that I have knighted my straight friends who I have allowed to tell homophobic jokes to me, I will knight you as the winner of the Boom Blu-ray.
Now, are we limiting this to listeners within the United States?
Listen, if you live in some far-flung other country, God bless you. You probably have a national health service. Sure. Why not?
So begrudgingly.
If you're good enough, I'll ship your Blu-ray to... Well, you know what? Your Blu-ray won't even work in those other countries.
Well, a lot of people have region-free
okay,
players.
Well, if it'll work, if you know that American stuff will work in your Blu-ray player, and you're clever enough to win this contest, I don't care where you live. I'll ship it to you. Just because I like you. I mean, I think I like you. If you win the contest, I totally like you. Because you made me happy. You entertained me. Yeah. But you have a week. Today is
Friday,
May 24th. So you have until next Friday, May 31st, to knock this out of the park and into our email.
May 31st, 11:59 p.m. Pacific time.
Correct.
That is the deadline. Linoleum Podcast.
I will be awake, no. But, you know.
linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Keep them to under 100 words.
Yeah. So just do it.
I'm excited to see what you guys get. This is the one where she freaks out at somebody at the airport. Is that right?
No, that's the driver's seat.
Oh, okay.
Also a good one.
All right.
This is the one where she wears the big crazy headdress, which actually inspired Gemma Chan's Met Gala look.
Oh, Okay.
So, oh, yeah. By the way, thank you again for including me in your piece about the Apple.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, of course.
That was part of the Met Gala camp preview.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what film better encapsulates
failure
seriousness?
I was disappointed that nobody showed up dressed as, like, you know, the hell sequence, frankly.
You know, that, like, there's one Flying Spaghetti Monster costume in that thing that just looks like they went to the hardware store and they got a bunch of, like, tubes for, like, wrapping, you know, like, the foam for wrapping around pipes. I mean, like, the wild careening of budget in that film is something that...
Like, the people with, like, with an extra, like, paper mache face on them. Like, there were so many options they could have gone with.
Oh, my gosh. And, like, yeah, just get a Napoleon costume at the Halloween store. That'll be fine. He's in hell. Why not?
Yeah, why? go for it.
Let's, we have, like, 5 movies to talk about.
Okay.
We're talking about Aladdin.
Mm-hmm.
Brightburn, Booksmart, The Souvenir, and We Have Always Lived in the Castle.
Yes.
Why don't we start with We Have Always Lived in the Castle?
Oh.
Since we talked about it a little bit last week and then decided we weren't going to do it immediately.
Oh, okay.
And then we forgot to talk about The Souvenir. So we're gonna get those out of the way right away
because they've been on the show.
They've been
for a
sitting
while.
For a minute.
Yes. Okay.
We want to make you wait for Aladdin.
We Have Always Lived in the Castle. You can get streaming. You can watch this movie right now. It's on Amazon and iTunes and all those places. It is the second film from director Stacey Passon, whose movie Concussion, the lesbian one, not the Will Smith one, is, I think, one of the best queer films of the last decade or so. So I was very excited to see what she was going to do as a follow-up. And I think she has made another terrific film, and it is totally different. Like, it's a period piece. It is an adaptation of the Shirley Jackson novel, which I have not read. And it is about this these sisters who sort of live in a fancy house.
It's fancy house is the wrong way to describe it, I think.
Like crumbling manor?
It is a crumbling manor.
Yeah.
It's sort of but the best kind, like the kind that even though you know like the ceiling might fall in on you, it still feels cozy and great because everything is old and heavy and you know, the wallpaper is like the kind that you covet.
It's like Grey Gardens without the raccoons.
Pretty much. It's not a destroyed house.
No.
It will be
by the end of the movie.
By the end of the movie. but it is a stately and depressing home, which is my dream house. Yeah.
So years earlier, the parents had been poisoned. The uncle, played by Crispin Glover, did not die, but was left wheelchair bound. And then, so that leaves him and the two daughters in the house. The older daughter is Alexandra Daddario, who everybody thought poisoned the parents. She was cleared by a trial, but everybody in the small town that they live right next to still suspects her. So she never leaves the house. She never leaves the grounds. She's, you know, agoraphobic. Also, like, she had one suitor and her rich, awful father drove him away.
And she never stops smiling.
Yes. She is like, she is giving you perfect housewife realness constantly.
It's a nonstop panic attack
that
she's having with this grin on her face.
And then the younger...
Formerly, I have seen this actress in Baywatch.
And San Andreas.
And San Andreas. So up to this point, I did not know...
She was an actress?
That she was an actress. I just was like, oh, you're a young lady that gets put in things because you're very pretty.
If you can get her away from Dwayne the Rock Johnson, apparently, like she contains multitudes.
Yeah. I say this all the time, you know, young, very attractive actors and actresses... Early in their careers, they are like adornments, really. Mm-hmm. And I always think to myself, if the movie is terrible,
it's not their fault.
I think, well, it can't be your fault because you're really new. And I see why they chose you for this part, because some producer thought you were hot.
Right.
And that always, you know, I put them in a special category of don't know what you are yet.
Yeah.
There's going to come a minute when I might find out. But this movie, we find out.
Yes, and I think it's one of those cases where either she or perhaps, like, you know, her team is like, hey, let's put you in a real movie.
Yeah.
You know, and so it, yeah.
That no one's going to see, but that people will remember who need to remember.
Exactly. Yeah. Casting directors and critics will see it, you know. Right. So, yeah, so she's quite good in this. And then the younger sister is played by Tessa Farmiga. And we're told that she is 18, but the way that she behaves in the film is, like, 14, you know, 12. she's very, like, tomboyish, and, you know, she's got the braids on the side of her head, and, you know,
angry.
Very, very angry and very stressed about the world in
simmering,
general,
you know,
constantly, yeah. like, burying these totems in the yard as an attempt to keep the family safe. She makes these weekly trips into town where, like, she's mocked, and it's just very, like, stressful. And into all of this, like, family craziness comes rich a-hole Sebastian Stan and his red sports car, who's a cousin who's there to visit the family, but really he's there for their money. And he, you know, manages to dazzle you know, the older sister enough to sort of, like, almost kind of take things over, but, you know, little sister is not having it. I think this movie's great. I really enjoyed it. And then I have seen middling responses to it. And I think, you know, if you're super into the book, maybe it's not quite giving you all the things you want from the book. But, you know, it doesn't announce itself. Like, the poster is so ridiculous. Like, they look so sort of ghostly and pallid and stuff. The movie does not sort of announce itself as a horror film, but it becomes, like, ever more sort of creepy and suspenseful as it carries on.
It is a creepy and suspenseful film. It is not a horror film.
It's not, no. But I think they're trying to market it as one.
Well, yeah. I mean, because an easy way.
You know, because the poster specifically references The Haunting of Hill House because of the Netflix show, I think, more than for the book.
Right.
Anyway,
right.
But I think that people should check this movie out because, you know,
big Crispin Glover fan.
Yep.
And he's given you full Crispin Gloverness in this
but in a restrained way, I think.
Yeah, very restrained.
Yeah.
And yeah, it looks good, it moves weirdly, everyone behaves weirdly.
You know, it's Shirley Jackson, so of course there's an ugly mob scene at one point.
This sounds like, it sounds intriguing. Do we leave the house, or is it sort of like a bottle movie?
Yeah.
Like I said, the younger sister does go into town every so often for supplies or whatever.
Leave the house sometimes.
But it's always very tense, and, like, people are staring at her, and small children will chant things at her. Like, by the end of the film, it's sort of like an origin story for, like, those weird sisters that live in that house that we don't ever deal with, but in a very kind of, like, well, here's how they got that way and why it's really your fault, you know.
My one complaint is that no one is ever referred to as a murderess. One of my favorite words.
Are you thinking of the scene from the movie Up, not the Disney film Up, but the Russ Meyer Up, where someone says, it's some line like, take that, murderess. it's so delicious.
Look,
I have a confession.
I'm woke
I've
enough.
I've never seen Up.
I recommend it.
Russ
it's
Meyer's
fantastic.
Up. I've never seen it.
I have
it.
Not seen it either.
It starts with a naked woman in a tree who says, "So, warrior, sheathe your sword to the hilt. Are you up to it?" And sets a tone.
I think Roger Ebert, like, anonymously co-wrote that one.
Yes. Oh, it has that feel.
Yeah. I am woke, so I refer to whatever gender, they're all murderers. It's like comedienne, you know, it's a word I don't use anymore.
But here's the thing.
We don't say lady murderer.
If you're a lady who murders, you already are, like, outside of the world. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you want a special accolade, don't you?
You want to be recognized?
You want to be recognized for your accomplishment and for your contributions to your gender. And therefore, I think murderess is something that is we should not lose.
Well, if you go on What's My Line and Dorothy Kilgallen figures out what you do, she will say, "Are you a lady murderer?"
Fine. You go be woke. I'll stay right here with my cozy murderess.
No, murderess is a great word. I just always remember there was an interview with Elaine Boozler back in the day where she talked about how she hated the word comedian because you never call somebody a doctorella.
I think that would also be really cool.
Honestly, I want to see that movie. I want to see a movie called Doctorella.
Doctorella Psychedrella.
Speaking of ladies doing things, here's the transition. The Souvenir. The new film from Joanna Hogg.
Whose previous films I have not seen, but are all screening on the Criterion Channel.
They're all on the Criterion Channel right now. So this apparently is sort of semi-autobiographical.
That's what I'm hearing, yes.
Which gives me a little bit of hope for part two, which is already filming. For reasons I cannot divulge, because I don't believe in the existence of spoilers, but I do believe in letting people go into a film like this one, not knowing what is going to happen. And there goes a box on the floor. It fell right off.
So you're just making up your spoiler rules as they go along.
I am, all the time. Always. It is about a young woman in her early 20s in the early 1980s. She's a filmmaker. She's going to film school. And she's rich. She does not live at home. Her parents have installed her in a really nice apartment in the Knightsbridge area. Of London. Yes, yes, a flat. This woman is played by Honor Swinton Byrne, who is the daughter of Tilda Swinton.
Who plays her mother.
Tilda Swinton is also in the film playing her mother in a wig and outfits that would not feel out of place.
On QE2.
In We Have Always Lived in the Castle. It's that old, like, mum kind of clothing.
Yeah, like literal mumsy.
With like, perfect hair that flips at the bottom.
Uh-huh.
It's
under a little rain, you know, bonnet.
Some people want to see Tilda Swinton dressed as the monster in Suspiria. Some people want to see her dressed as the old man in Suspiria. Some people want to see her be the Doctor Strange character. I forget the name of the character.
The Ancient One.
The Ancient One. But I want to see her in old lady wigs.
Floral pastels.
And floral pastels, yes. And so I get my way through this entire film. So Honor Swinton Byrne is making a film about a world that has very little to do with her own. She wants to make a sort of, you know, early Mike Lee, Ken Loach sort of
working class
kitchen sink sort of film. And everyone around her is like, you don't know anything about that. And at the same time, she's also falling in love against not only her own better judgment, but the taste and better judgment of all the people who know her. With an older man in his 30s, played by Tom Burke, who works for the Foreign Office in what other country? France, yeah?
I just call it the Foreign Office.
The British Foreign Office. He is, from moment one,
bad news.
Bad news. The most colossal a-hole that you would ever want to meet. But he's not loud and obnoxious. He's
posh,
quiet and rich and withering and unpleasant and snotty and never stops smoking. And oops, we also learn a total heroin addict.
Yes.
Something that she comes to understand over time. And the entire film is a sometimes comedic, sometimes dramatic, always very quiet and hushed and murmured sort of exploration of this relationship and her own discovery of herself as an artist and as a young woman who gets to stand on her own outside of her family's money and outside of the boyfriend's, you know, domination. It is at times really funny and also at times really frightening, and you fear for her. Quite often when moneyed characters exist in film, I immediately fold my arms and think, to myself, why should I give a damn?
Funny. About, that's what I was thinking
about what
movie.
Happens to you. Yeah, I know. you're going to get your minute here in just a minute. Alonso didn't like it. But the filmmaking, Joanna Hogg's filmmaking is so full of empathy for this young woman. And gets me, at least, over the hump of, you're rich. Why should any of this be bothering you? Like, what you see by the end of the film is that, you know, you can grow up poor and struggling, or you can grow up rich and privileged, and a lot of human problems are the same. And the way you have to deal with them is, you know, site-specific sometimes. So I won't give away anything that happens, but there are a few sequences in this film that filled me with deep, deep anxiety about what is going to happen to this character, this young woman, in the future. Especially when I learned at the end of the credits that there's a part two coming. Uh-huh. They say this in the credits. Stay tuned for part two.
She'll be back in Moonraker.
Yeah, exactly. And when I saw that, I thought, oh no.
The souvenir chapter two, Parabellum.
Stuff goes down here that could bode badly.
Yeah. And explain the title in a way that's very unsettling.
Yeah. The title is actually in reference to a painting by Fragonard that she goes to a museum with Tom Burke to look at. Anyway, I love this movie. It is a very small and very specific thing, and it's very intuitive about young people and how they get over their lack of self-assurance and learn to be what they feel like they need to become. I really love it. It's maybe one of my favorite things I've seen all year.
I'll give the movie this. If you're going to see The Souvenir, do not see it at the end of a long and tiring work day.
That is correct, because it's very quiet and people are... They kind of talk like this.
Yeah. So much murmur. So it is quite possible that I was in the wrong headspace and the wrong everything to see the movie, and maybe I'll catch up with it again years later and be like, oh, now I get it. I found it unspeakably tedious with a lead character that I wanted to smack in the face because it was like, honey, this guy has trouble written on him in 8-foot letters, and you're just like, and it's like, you've got to be kidding me.
How smart were you about your life when you were 24?
I'm
23.
Okay. No. I hear what you're saying, but there is a way to tell that story in film and make a character either relatable or at least empathetic and understanding. I just was sitting outside going, honey, no.
I believe the filmmaking accomplishes that empathetic.
Okay, well, quality. I do not. I found this just unending, and it was just so cringeworthy. It drove me up the wall. I mean, yes, it's beautifully made. There's a lot of craft here. This is a woman who has made the movie that she wants to make. I'm not...
This is especially the kind of movie where I was sitting there thinking about the composition of the frame. Like, yeah. I was noticing a lot of that.
It's all very understated, and it's consistently so. There is clearly an aesthetic at work here. But... I was never, ever...
Everybody's got a big butt.
I've got a huge butt. I was never drawn into this story or to these characters. I had no interest in what was playing out. All I could think about was like, you're a ninny and you're rich, so why am I even here?
That's why I dropped out of Downton Abbey, honestly.
Really?
You guys are fine. You're fine.
Everything's going to be okay for all of you.
Yeah.
Well, I see. For me in Downton Abbey, it's like, you know, the unspoken thing is like, at some point, like, once World War II is over, none of this is happening. So enjoy, like, smoke them while you got them, you know.
Sure, sure.
Well, with Downton Abbey, it was, for me, specifically incident, you know, driven.
Yeah, it's soapy.
I never cared about, the only people I cared about, really cared about, on the show were Lady Edith, of course. Mm-hmm. And will she ever get over her googly eyes and find true love? Or and also, you know, Anna and Mr. Bates. Yes. You want everything. Oh, the little maid, what's her name?
Oh, Daisy.
Daisy. I wanted those four people to come out of it okay. Right? But everyone else, I was like, no one gives a damn what happens to Lady Mary because she's going to run the world.
Yeah.
No matter where she is. But that was, like I said, that was all incident driven. This is about people.
Yeah.
And they're screwed up insides.
I tend not to watch trailers, but now that we're doing it for Breakfast All Day as part of our Patreon, I have to. Did y'all see the Downton Abbey trailer that dropped this week?
Yeah.
No, I have not seen the trailer.
It's more of the same, which if you're not into it, you're not into it. And if you are, you know, it's more of the same.
September, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's the perfect kickoff to fall then.
Yes. Yeah. It's as middle brow as you can get.
Yeah.
It felt like, just as you're saying, more of the same and a bit heightened. So we're going to see you know, no spoilers for the trailer, I guess, yeah. But you know, like they're doing the same thing, but now the stakes are raised and they're higher. And I like by the end of it, I was like, this feels like one of the trailers where like there's a twist at the end and it turns out that one of them can fly now or something. Like that feels like the escalation that we're getting at this point.
Look, I just, they had me in the teaser just by having like a crane shot going all the way up the building. It's like,
I will say this, yes, it had some photography that like I've not seen of the setting. And yes. I was like, oh, well, you know, honestly, I'm just very interested in seeing some very nice shots of that building.
Yes. And it's 1927, so the Dowager is still legitimately alive.
That's the one. That's the only character I care about. What is a weekend?
Is she meant to be like 100 now? Like, she's meant to be very, very
She would
old.
Be getting up there, yeah. Mm-hmm. But like, I just thought, because I heard, at one point I heard it was going to be like World War II, and I was like, there's no way the Dowager is still around that long. Like, no. She barely made it through World War I.
No, and she will guarantee you
die in the
she
movie.
She dies in the movie.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Guaranteed she dies in the film. Yeah. Just as a good narrative punch, you know, to make you sad that there will be no more acerbic barbs thrown at anyone.
Yeah.
Because if anybody deserves acerbic barbs thrown at them, it's everyone in this show.
That's true. They all need a read. Replace them with a drag queen. Give them like a drag queen character on the show or something. And, yeah.
Lady Mary, meet Lady Chablis.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, you're still here doing that? Okay. Let's move on.
And yes, I know Lady Chablis passed away. R.I.P.
Oh, did she?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
She did.
It can be young Lady Chablis, like contemporaneous. Yes. I don't know if she was alive in 27, but
when did this happen? I didn't know about this.
Like in the last year or two, I think.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, well, I this is news to me. I feel very
am
sad
I am
this.
I right?
I believe you are. Yeah.
Okay. Now you got me questioning it.
No, she did. Okay. September 8th, 2016. It's been 3 years almost.
Yeah.
I did not know. Okay. Well then, sorry, Lady Chablis. I didn't know that about you. I read her book.
Rest in Power.
I read her book back in the day, yeah. In the 90s.
Hiding Your Candy.
Yeah.
Or Hiding My Candy, whatever it was.
Hiding the Candy. Yeah. What? Okay. Aladdin. Go.
Well, actually, this is the movie that our guest has seen. So
go.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Hey, Matt Baum. Tell us about Aladdin.
I thought it was a perfectly... It was four or five perfectly fine movies. you know, it's like,
what's it about? In case people have not seen the 1992
animated version
film,
sure, or read Arabian Nights or any of that stuff,
or know anything about
culture.
Like, yeah,
it's sort of I don't know. There's a bit of a Prince and the Pauper aspect where like this street rat with not a penny to his name aspires to something greater, kind of, and then like the rich lady in the castle. Going back to this theme, the rich lady high on the hill is curious about like how her subjects live and their paths cross, and the movie seems like every maybe like 10 minutes or so it seemed like a little alarm went off and the movie was like, oh sorry, I need to be about something for a minute. Okay, now back to what we were doing. Because they're like ideas in this film in a way that honestly surprised me. Like, I thought we were just going to get a retread of the original, the animated version, the 92 or 93 version.
92, yeah.
Yeah. And it did an interesting job of being faithful to aspects of that, and I thought introducing a few new bits and pieces that honestly seemed interesting, but we just didn't get to go anywhere with them.
Like?
Oh man, that handmaid. I mean, she was, I kept forgetting her name.
Dahlia.
Dahlia.
Nassim Pedrad.
She stole the gosh darn show for me.
Every scene she's in. Yeah.
I wanted a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are in love about her and the genie.
Yeah.
Like, that was phenomenal. And there's some interesting ideas in there about aspirations that I don't think were in the original. And there's some interesting ideas about wealth redistribution that were not in there.
You know, this movie does seem a little tone deaf about class at times.
At times very interested in it, and at others completely ignores.
Yeah. Yeah. Like there's a big plot hinge toward the end, and maybe it's this way in the cartoon too. I haven't seen it in decades. But where basically the genie gets mad at Aladdin because Aladdin doesn't want to come clean about his origins, just wants to like fake prince his way into, you know, marrying the princess and living in the castle. And I'm thinking, like, the American story of wealth attribute of new money basically is people faking it until they make it and like passing themselves off as something else and worming their way into society and then once they're there, behaving like they've been there all along. So I didn't judge Aladdin for not wanting to tell that part, you know?
Right. You want to Meghan Markle that situation.
Exactly.
There's an interesting line where someone, I can't remember which character says it, maybe it's Jasmine, says, when you're royalty, no one gets to see the real you. And it was an interesting moment about like the necessity of disguise and deceit. Like it's sort of challenges how you feel like Aladdin takes kind of a heel turn because he's like not being honest. But then Jasmine has an interesting line that she doesn't even realize is interesting in the context of what's going on.
Sure.
About why sometimes you find yourself by assuming an identity. And that is interesting and queer, and I want to explore that with you, Jasmine. Wait, oh, but no, you're flying away on a carpet.
Right, yeah.
So this is yet another live action remake of a Disney animated classic, and what I will give this movie points for better or for worse, is that it's not afraid to be a musical. You know, like Beauty and the Beast really, you know, owned it and reveled in it, but a lot of the other ones, specifically like Jungle Book and stuff, just kind of glancingly will include like the song that you might know, but not really go whole hog in it.
It's also not afraid to be a frantic, messy musical.
Yes, that's the thing. How good a musical it is another topic entirely.
They definitely break out into song, but it felt like a dress rehearsal to me. Like, people are just not filling the frame. They're not moving around. I'm like, could Baz Luhrmann just like be airlifted in at some point to do something about this?
That's been our ongoing joke. Yeah. Like, so many people think they can be Baz Luhrmann, but it's not working. And Guy Ritchie, I think an unfettered Guy Ritchie musical would be something interesting if he could bring all of his, like, you know, crazy edits and sped up stuff and whatever, the, you know, his paint box to it. But he is so operating with, like, you know, the bags on his hands or whatever, like Disney is making him make their kind of movie, and as such, yeah, it just winds up like Bibbs in his review for the Rhapsody, it looks like it's, you know, set in one of the chintzier corners of Adventureland. You know, it doesn't,
yeah,
like if you're gonna be as CG as this movie clearly is, you might as well like really go crazy with the orientalism, you know. Like, do you ever see Kismet?
No.
It's an old MGM musical, not one of the better remembered ones, but it has the same kind of like faux Arabic Fantasia, you know, Western version going on. And there are moments in like the Prince Ali number, which there are things about it I like and things about it that totally clunk, but that reminded me of like the big sort of spectacles of like Not Since Nineveh or whatever from that movie. But yeah, you're right. There's not, I don't think he has a feel for this.
It never really, the punch never lands.
Yeah.
You know, there's like, you got peacocks and they're doing something and you got like swirling scarves and stuff, but it just, it's like, I don't, and the end of that song, in fact, I could feel, you know that feeling you get when like a kick line's coming? And I don't know if this is just some queer sense that we have, but like, you know, from like 15 minutes away when you gotta gird your loins for a kick line and you can feel it coming and the music's about to do it, and then they don't.
And the song totally loans itself to it.
I know, right. I know. And then they're just
Prince Ali,
my jaw was dropped by that. It was the most jaw-dropping moment of the film for me, that they didn't do a kick line. And I'm like, do straight people just not know about kick lines?
Give me some 5, 6, 7, 8.
I know. I was offended. I was that was the worst homophobia of the film.
That sequence was especially frustrating to watch because there's so much happening and so little of it makes it to my eyeballs that I just like, come on. I should be thrilled right now.
Yeah.
I should feel like...
Take me away.
I should feel goosebumps now from the extravagance of this. And it's the money's up there. You can look at it, but it's just the camera's like a pinball machine. It's just like bing, 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 bing everywhere. And so that annoying. I thought that the two leads who played Aladdin and Princess Jasmine, not a lot going on there.
Oh, man. If
they can sing.
And dance, like good dancers.
And can dance. And he, unfortunately for me, this is a personal preference, he sings in a very particular young male Broadway kind of way that drives me insane. She's nice. But she is a singer. Like, yeah. That's her her background. Career. She's a singer before being a
dancer. I thought he was kind of a stiff Mina Massoud, unless he's on screen with Will Smith, in which case that seems to draw something out of him. I kind of like Naomi Scott. I thought, look, Disney princess is a thankless role.
I know.
She's a little too damsel for me. Yeah. Still, like, she had some moments, but still, like, you know, the movie, the film, like, not to give anything away, but there are some moments where she is literally unable to move, and... you know, once again, I'm like, can we just give the woman some agency in this movie?
Will Smith, on the other hand, was my favorite thing in the whole movie. Like, consistently, he's always on screen doing what he needs to do. Mm-hmm. And I said this today, we just came back from being on KCRW. And I don't know how much of what I said got edited out for the sake of the little 10-minute time slot we have, but I'll say it again. In my head, what happened was Jaden and Willow took him and said, "Dad, sit down. We're going to watch Paris is Burning as a family." And then when it was over, they said, "Now, go be that genie." Because there is something so free about his performance. He is... In spite of the fact that he's largely CGI, it's like his face attached to what? A cartoon? Like, there is something so...
House of LaBeija.
There is a lot of loose wrist going on and a pleasure on his part at being this sort of like gender relaxed person
it's goosey in a good way.
At one point he's even in drag in a musical number.
Yes,
like the whole thing. And I thought, okay, you're having fun, and you really seem to be having fun. Like, it doesn't feel like anyone's coercing you to be, like you said, goosey, which is a word I love, not as much as I love murderess, but almost. And yeah, with his time on screen was sort of pleasurable for me.
Yeah, he's having a good time. This is like Big Willy style Will Smith and not 7 pounds Will Smith, you know.
He was, yeah, a joy to watch, and not just because he's the only one who gets to show his nipples. He is legitimately entertaining. Right. Well, animated.
Those were CG
was the word.
Nipples, I'm sure.
You know what? I'll take what I can get. There's, yeah, this is the other
problem. Do I need to take off my shirt right now?
If we must.
Okay.
That Aladdin's wearing a shirt throughout the film. Like, once again, what are you guys doing? But, yeah, no, I thought he was,
yeah,
like...
Yeah, cartoon Aladdin is shirtless.
Oh,
just
that's
a little
true.
Vest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And inhuman Aladdin is like...
He's got
up.
Casual separates.
You see chest, but you can also see that it has been shaved.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like Bronson Aladdin. Yeah. Like, oh, we can't, you know, spook the horses or something by showing too much skin. Frustrating. But yeah, I was going to say Aladdin, or the genie is the word I was going to use was animated. Whoops. But yeah, he really, like, is exciting and engaging to watch, and which is why the handmaid character, when those two characters have more chemistry than our two leads, leads.
True.
And like they're doing like a lot of acting, and like our leads are just like, it just feels like they're reading the lines.
Well, it's that thing of, you know, like this is what like Marx Brothers movies, you know, there'd be like the ingenue that nobody cared about, you know, like mm-hmm. the lead couple and their like romantic duets. And then there was the rest of the movie that was the fun part. Like I remember thinking the same way about that remake of About Last Night from a couple years ago. I do not remember who the romantic leads are. I do remember Kevin Hart and Regina Hall as the actual yep. funny, yep. charismatic chemistry people in the yep. movie.
Now, I would like to crap on it a little more.
Okay.
All right. If you stay over the end credits, you stay for the final credits, you will hear Will Smith rapping.
Aww.
And it is apparent that he has not done this for a couple of decades now, because I hope he didn't write the words to the thing that he is doing, but he at one point describes himself as a genie with an attitude. And I'm like, no, come on, dude. You just
was there a reference to climate change in that song?
I don't know. Also, I think the production design is largely barf.
Yeah.
There is... there's a lot of, orangey silks, but like the big cave,
mm-hmm. yeah,
it's just gross, you know, and ugly. And you go back and look at the animated feature, it's just like this stately, deep blue, you know, tomb that you want to go die in, you know, yeah.
Even in A Whole New World, like, they're singing about, like, the majesty of the planet, basically. And yeah. I'm just like, yeah, it's okay. Like, I've seen better shots on, like, you know, on
screensavers. Soaring over California?
Yeah, for real. Like, they're like, oh, they're, like, singing about it like it's majestic. And, you know, I watched the original animated version a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. And, like, there's just such beautiful, like, classic... whichever golden age of Disney that was, there's been like seven of them, but
right.
you know, it's like gorgeous, gorgeous art. And in this one, it just feels like, you know, it feels like Google Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, would I be happy if they never did another one of these movies? Absolutely.
What's coming down the road?
I don't know. Lion King later this year. That's the one that we're all supposed to be excited about.
When is that happening?
This year?
Summer?
Yeah, beats me.
Fall, maybe? I don't know. I believe it's this year. There are lists online of like there's like a dozen different ones in various stages of production.
Oh, really?
Also, Maleficent. That many? Maleficent 2, if you're counting that as well.
But I'm not really counting Maleficent.
Is there going to be a Bambi? I'm afraid they're going to make a Bambi at some point. I don't know.
No.
Yeah, there's so many, like, or I don't know, like, the parent, not the parent.
The Aristocats?
Yeah, the Aristocats, yeah.
The Lion King comes out in July.
Oh, I think we're getting a Lady and the Tramp.
We are getting a Lady and the Tramp.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
We're getting a Lady and the Tramp, and I think we are getting a Pinocchio.
Oh, gosh, that's been tried so many times. The Jonathan Taylor Thomas one is
They're bringing back Roberto Benigni for this one.
There is some body horror in that movie. It is a dark, dark film. Yeah.
So, it's all going to be all
but
right.
Anyway,
yeah,
but
anyway. It's fine.
Anyway, I was saying, like, would I be happy if they didn't stop doing these entirely? Yes, I would. Is this one of the okay ones?
Yeah.
Sure. It's not as good as Pete's Dragon. It's a hell of a lot better than Dumbo, you know. Dumbo was another one that kind of skirted the this was a musical at one point
thing. I want someone with power at Disney to say, for every one of these that we do, we're going to make a $30 million movie that is like The Journey of Natty Gann.
Well, that's the thing. When I was watching this movie, I was thinking to myself, if this weren't based on a cartoon, would anybody make this movie as a live action musical?
No.
And of course not.
No.
You know, and it's like, and nor necessarily should they, because it doesn't translate in the same way. It doesn't have the same vim that the animated version did. But yeah, people talk about how, I don't want to see any more superhero movies. If I got to pick, the thing that I never want to see anymore is these live action remakes.
I want, because you know, last week you and I, for your birthday, we went out to the New Beverly to see The Secret Garden, the 1993 Agnieszka Holland version of The Secret Garden, which roughly came out around the same time as Natty Gann.
Yeah, like and Aladdin.
A couple years later.
Well, and it was part of that whole, that chunk of like mid-90s live action kid lit adaptations we were talking about.
Yes.
Like Black Beauty and Little Women and Little Princess, you know.
If I would like Disney to be in the business of making original live action films that aren't this.
Yeah. There are good stories to be told out there
one
somewhere.
And they have to do one for every big tentpole.
Well,
that's their Faustian bargain.
Maybe they'll make them for Disney Plus.
No, I need to go to a movie theater.
No, I agree with you, but I'm just saying, Disney's just getting more evil in their old age. So,
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Like within like another 10 or so years, we're going to see the remake of this remake. You know, they're just going to continue to recycle. And it's going to be in virtual reality or whatever we're doing at that point if we haven't all been consumed.
The chip that goes to the base of our skull, yeah.
Let's talk about Brightburn.
Yes, tell us.
Only I have seen The Brightburn.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to see it last night at the Grove, not only was the theater mostly empty, which does not bode well for its opening weekend.
There were quite a few people at my Aladdin screening.
But I didn't know a thing about it. Not one thing.
You and your bubble.
I had not seen a trailer. I had not read a synopsis. I had no idea what this film was going to be.
Hmm.
Now, if you go to IMDb, they tell you immediately what this film is. Here's what they say on IMDb. What if a child from another world crash-landed on Earth? But instead of becoming a hero to mankind, he proved to be something far more sinister.
That presupposes that a child who crashes on... Oh, I guess Superman. Okay, I see what they're saying. Yeah, all right.
What if Superman came, and when Superman was a 12-year-old boy, decided, you know what? F everybody.
Look what I can do.
Which is honestly what I'd expect from someone of that age.
I am going to ruin all of you. One by one, murder. Four kicks.
Robert Abele reviewed it for The Wrap, and his lead was, what if Superman as a child were evil, and what if that were the only idea you had for your horror movie?
Mm.
It kind of is. He's not wrong. It kind of is the only idea they have. But its execution makes it a kind of cool idea.
Mm.
Because what if Superman was a child serial killer? So you have the trappings of a superhero movie, a person with, you know, absolute power to zap you, fly, super strength, know what's going on, you know, at any given moment. And then, you know, marches around the film like, you know, Patty McCormick meets Macaulay Culkin, and you know what I mean? Like this.
That's the bad seed meets the good son.
There's nothing wrong. I'm fine. I've just discovered that I'm very special. How special? You'll find out. And he's like that the whole film, which is super entertaining. Elizabeth Banks plays his mother. David Denman, whose name I finally just learned. I have always just referred to him as, you know, that hot bearded guy from The Office.
Yes.
Like the one who works in the warehouse.
The one who was engaged to What's-Her-Face for the first season.
Yeah, What's-Her-Face.
Yeah.
I hate
Jenna Fisher. I never watched the show.
Barely watched the show.
I've watched it some, but I forget. Yeah. Pam.
Pam.
Pam's fiance for season from season one.
Yeah, okay.
So he plays the dad. And they know the secret. The little spaceship crash landed on their farm in the middle of Kansas. They hid the spaceship in the barn under some boards, and then they adopted, you know, in air quotes, the kid. And didn't really think much of it other than, you know, oh, why is he beginning to behave strangely? He sets about murdering everybody, one by one, in really violent and gnarly ways, which will appeal to all people like me who love nasty gore and point of impact punctures and killings, body parts separated from the body, things like that. For fun. I'm really into it. And that's about as far as it goes. It is an entertaining horror movie about a kid that is unstoppable. And it thinks that it's making a commentary about that man who is the president.
Oh, no.
Without ever saying his name, without ever mentioning the fact that, you know, it's taking place now in a rural, you know, area of a red state. You see bits and pieces of the world around you that are hot button items, you know, right these days. Like there's a scene where a family member tries to give the kid a shotgun for his 12th birthday, but the parents are like, no, no guns. You know, we abhor violence.
Even though the dad hunts.
Even though the dad hunts. He's like, you're a kid, you can't have a gun yet.
Well, yeah. You don't have to abhor violence to be like, maybe this 12-year-old should never.
Unless it's a deer, yeah. Then there's a scene where this little girl that the kid is, you know, for lack of a better word, stalking, is seen writing a school paper about, you know, post-truth in the modern world. There are a lot of anxious atmospheric references to the contemporary political climate, but no commentary, really. No, it's not satire. It's not trying to make a point other than this is the world we're all swimming in right now, and doesn't it suck? You know?
Yeah, I already know that. I don't need to go to a movie.
Right.
The reason that I'm not interested in seeing this is because it's a James Gunn joint. Not that he didn't write or direct it, but he produced it, and it's written by, like, his brother and his cousin.
Okay.
And he's, like, very involved in its creation.
Okay.
And he previously made a superhero dark satire called Super, which yes. I despise.
Right.
And so, pass.
you're just gonna pass on it just because of the earlier film he made.
Yeah.
All right. The like director
is named. If he works for Marvel, even if he works for DC, I'll watch those movies. But his like, yeah, man, this is my dark vision. Yeah,
well, the director's name is David Yaroveski.
Yes. Who has worked on Guardians and
right.
You know.
Yes. I found this to be an entertaining horror film. Effectively creepy. Occasionally frightening. They got me with a couple jump scares. Usually doesn't happen to me, but they got me.
Get her.
There is some stuff that happens at the end, which I found unsettling in a way that I also... unsettling, but... tipping into the what I consider to be exploitation of recent history. Uh-huh. And I have railed against it in other films, but that have done the same thing. But it came out of the blue and is seems to be only a reference point and not again
a direct,
you know, comment on stuff. Mm-hmm. So this is a film of the Trump era that neither endorses nor actively seeks to critique anything. It just lives in that world.
So it just sort of name drops concepts, but doesn't
right. Yeah.
Follow up.
But on I still that. Had a good time because there's lots of cool killings.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
And you know, a child is committing all the killings, which that's
who,
great.
Who can kill a child?
Yeah. Well, people try. They don't succeed. And then, all right, finally, Booksmart.
Yes. Finally. Thank heavens.
Please. Talk about Booksmart, Alonzo.
Booksmart, directorial debut of actress Olivia Wilde. It stars Caitlin Dever. I found out, it turns out I was mispronouncing her name on Breakfast All Day.
It's Dever?
It is Dever.
Not Dever.
It is Dever.
All right.
And Beanie Feldstein as two best friends who are about to graduate from high school. They have been like super nose to the grindstone, you know, hardcore nerds, judging the popular people to get into good schools. And on the last day of class before graduation, they discover that the people that they thought were sort of beneath them or were slacking or not taking things seriously also got into really good schools while still partying and having social lives and not being total dorks.
Can I digress for just a moment?
Yes.
One of my favorite jokes in the movie, and this happens very early, is the reason they didn't know that the other people that they went to school with were also going to these fancy Ivy League schools. This, by the way, is an upper middle class atmosphere where no one talks about money,
right,
or where tuition is coming from, or anything like that. That is the world that this film lives in.
Just go with it.
I accepted it. Otherwise, if the film had been about something more serious, related to real life struggle,
you would call shenanigans.
I would call shenanigans, but this is a comedy about something other than that.
Yeah.
Anyway, the reason they don't know that the other kids are going to Ivy League schools is because they have all decided and agreed as a graduating class not to divulge the names of the colleges that they're going to so as to avoid any hurt feelings. And I was talking to a person the other day who has also seen this movie, who is 19 years old. And I said, okay, Generation Z, how do you feel about that? And he said, accurate.
And really?
He goes, accurate. And he said, and just a mean, mean, mean joke about us. And he said, and I'm here for it. And I said, thank you. Because I feel like the movie is making a joke about the thing that people always criticize the millennials and the Gen Z kids for.
Sensitivity.
They're having fun with that.
Yeah.
With that moment.
And turning it into a plot device.
And turning it into a plot point. Yeah.
So the popular mean girl who's also going to Yale, you know, when Beanie Feldstein's character can't wrap her head around that, she goes, we cared about all that stuff too. We just didn't only care about school. So this leaves our two heroines deciding that they have to like live it up and pack 4 years of partying into one crazy night. So
it's a
one crazy night movie, which is a genre that has yielded some really good movies, you know, American Graffiti, Dazed and Confused, you know, Can't Hardly Wait, 16 Candles.
Can I just give a shout out for a moment to the forgotten but extremely wicked Project X?
I'm not as into that one as you are, but okay,
what a,
sure.
That movie's like over the edge. You know what I mean?
Like the
movie Over the Edge, yeah. Anyway, go on.
But played for laughs.
But kind of played for laughs, which that's why I call it wicked.
Anyway, so, you know, wacky hijinks ensue as these two girls are trying to find, like, the cool party, and then they find the cool party, and, you know, a lot of things go down. I love this movie. I love how smart it is. I love these characters. I love the sort of pool of kooky students around them, particularly ones played by Skylar Gisondo and Billy Lord.
Billy Lord walks away with every scene she's in.
Yeah.
She shows up and you forget what anyone else is doing.
You're just watching her.
You're just watching her be wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This movie is so queer. I had no idea. One of the two leads is a lesbian and is out. And I mean, she's never done anything, which is one of the goals of the evening, you know?
Right.
But like, it was just so matter of fact. And there's like other queer, there's like the theater kids who are like, you know, one of the parties they wind up accidentally winding up at is like this murder mystery party that the theater kids are throwing, you know, and it's the kid from The Real O'Neills.
Oh, yeah.
That guy. And I was enchanted by this film. It's funny and it's believable. And I saw a lot of myself in these characters. You know, there is something about like being in high school and one way to defend against the possibility that the popular kids might not like you is to judge them first.
Hate them first.
Yeah.
Hate them early and often.
Exactly.
Now, so I don't disagree with that.
I totally related to that part of it.
And the reason I don't disagree with that is because we're old.
Yes.
And we grew up with a paradigm of teen movies that posited us against them. And them were always one-dimensional villains.
Yeah.
They were all James Spader. And so you didn't have to think about them or who they were or what they dreamt about or what they felt bad about or what they were worried about, because not only were they one-dimensional, but they seemed more adult than the heroes, which made it even easier to keep your distance from them in terms of your own viewer empathy. This movie flips the script on these girls in the first 10 minutes and says, oh yeah, by the way, everything you thought about your life was completely wrong.
And everything you assumed
And
everything you assumed about your classmates also. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was enchanted by this film. I told this story on Madeline Brand. I don't know if it made it the cut or not, but like a thing I never knew about myself that Dave pointed out during the screening is that when I'm really enjoying a movie, usually like a comedy or a horror film,
when you're very excited during a movie and laughing or like being,
I sweat
like an ox.
I start perspiring. Yeah. And so like when I peeled my hoodie off or my flannel shirt, whatever I was wearing, over another shirt during the screening. And Dave was like, oh, Alonzo's enjoying this.
That was what I thought. You peeled off the top of the shirt and the second shirt you were wearing. And I thought, oh, he's having a good time because he's hot and sweaty.
Working
right
up
now.
A sweat.
Yeah.
Okay. How does it compare to, like, your description of it makes me think of both the movie Heathers and also kind of makes me think of, was it Superbad that had McLovin?
Yes. It's funny because, I mean, Beanie Feldstein is Jonah Hill's sister. Oh. So structurally, it does have the Superbad thing of the sort of nerdy kids trying to do a cool thing over one night of a bunch of, you know, things. But this movie is different in that it feels a lot more... It's a lot more empathetic, and it's very female-driven.
I like that.
It is the anti-Heathers.
Great.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Because, and I said this today on the radio, I don't know if it made the cut. As I watched this, I thought about, of all films, High School Musical. Now, when High School Musical was on the Disney Channel back in the mid-2000s, my two little nieces were really into it. They were not in high school. They were little, right? But in their minds, that was what high school was going to be. Okay. So what they walked into high school thinking was, we're all in this together.
We just need to find a way to relate. Yeah.
I sat down with them one time and watched it. And I was like, oh, I understand the appeal of this.
Mm.
Because don't you want to live in a world where people, if you just have the conversation, people will understand you?
Wasn't that Breakfast Club?
Wouldn't that be nice? Well, Breakfast Club's a little overwrought, really.
Sure, sure.
It hews closer to reality than High School Musical, though.
And the hierarchical nature of the John Hughes films that gives you, you know, clear-cut heroes and villains and popular kids and unpopular kids and stuff like that. That doesn't exist here. This film is book smart, is very, very generous in a way that High School Musical was, by giving you a bunch of kids who all do a lot of different things, none of whom are bad.
They all have like inner lives and
motivations.
They've
all got inner lives, even the rich ones and the jocks and the...
Like almost everyone seems willing to even just give these gals a chance after having been snubbed by them for their entire high school career.
Right. So I found that fascinating, and I think it is, if it is successful, it could, you know, be a push forward in making teenage movies more, ultimately, more real. Because there are not actual one-dimensional villains. Anywhere you go, there are people you don't like for this or that reason. There are people who are cruel for this or that reason.
Your bully has a backstory.
And sometimes you're the bully. Yeah. It was that episode of 30 Rock where Liz Lemon goes to her to her reunion and they're like, oh, we all hate you because you were so mean to us.
Yeah, like she thinks of herself as having been the victim and misunderstood. Yeah. And then she gets to her high school reunion and they're like, no, we were terrified of you. You were so mean to us.
Yeah. So I see this and I hear film critics who are our age and older talking about how they can't relate.
Dudes.
And they don't know what, yeah, male film critics, and they don't understand where the bad kids are. Like, where are the mean kids? Where are the mean girls? Where are the Heathers? Well, they're not in this movie. Mm. And the movie knows they're not in this movie, and the movie wants them not to be in this movie. Mm. That felt refreshing.
Yeah, Fast Times at Ridgemont High doesn't have any mean people. It has, you know, jerks and you know...
Okay, not mean, but, you know, it's got some pretty crappy dudes.
immature twits, yes. But.
Okay. So, yeah, this is... Okay, first of all, it doesn't look all that good. It's not, you know... Let's not call this cinema, shall we? It is a competently made, you know...
It doesn't look bad. It just doesn't do anything special. That hey, the house where the party takes place, the one they're eventually going to,
yeah,
is pretty rad.
It is suburban tacky from like 15 years ago. Yeah,
I don't know. I thought it was like an old like kind of 60s. Like there was a sunken, there was a conversation pit. There was like some right. interesting,
like someone's story. Old aunt lives there.
Yeah,
that's literally the house.
Somebody's aunt. Yeah.
So No, I'm not saying the sets. I'm talking just about...
I know what you mean. Camera placement and the lighting.
Does this movie look good? It doesn't look all that great. And how much of it was written versus how much of it was just sort of like brought into, you know, fruition by these great, you know, performers.
Yeah, but how many awful comedy, improv comedies with talented people?
But Olivia Wilde is what I really liked about this. She's holding it all together.
Yes.
And giving all these kids this space to make a film that is very, 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 very much about kids right now.
Yeah.
Whether you understand those kids or not, you know, it's very funny too.
Yeah. You were saying about The Souvenir, this is definitely going to be one of my favorite films of 2019.
That's exciting because I think that premise of like let's understand everyone's motivations could be done really ham-fistedly, and it sounds like they dodge that.
Yeah, it's not.
It's mainly the movie mines laughs out of the fact that these two girls have made such enormous assumptions about people that they have spent the last 4 years with, you know, and them come to the realization of like, oh, you know?
There's a scene where they are having the big fight blowout of, as you know,
between them.
And everyone stops and looks and begins filming with their cameras. And as they're fighting, music takes over and you stop being able to hear what they're saying. And what I love about that moment is that it's papering over a bad memory in the way that your actual memory will as you age. Mm. You'll remember, oh, remember that night we had that terrible, terrible fight? And you'll say, what was that about? And you'll both say, I can't exactly remember. And I thought that was really lovely.
Yeah.
Do you think, is this movie being made from the point of view of somebody who's in their, I don't know, like 30s or something and reflecting back on it?
Probably, yeah. But given the kids things they need to say today.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of very sort of contemporary touches in terms of like, you know, one of the girls has the War in 2020 sticker on her car, you know, and that kind of thing. But yeah, a lot of these concerns obviously are timeless in a way. But I think certainly the agency of the queerness does feel very modern.
That's extremely exciting.
Yeah, it is very modern, and
I mean it is so like nobody makes a big deal about it. Like even
just baked into the story.
Yeah, like the kids don't care. Her parents are well-meaning Christians, and so they're sort of like, uncomfortable, but always trying to be supportive nonetheless anyway. And they're played by Lisa Kudrow and Will Forte. You know, so yeah, like it is such a non-issue in the movie. Like, that's really exciting. And it makes me kind of, you know, as somebody who's programming Outfest, making me realize that there's so much of my filter and my experience of how I look at these topics that is going to be, that is constantly changing for young people who didn't deal with the same stuff or are dealing with a whole different set of stuff, you know, that it just kind of reminds me to kind of keep on my toes to sort of like, where are we now with the gay? Because I'm tend to be frozen in my version, and there's a lot going on out there.
Right. Big Eden is no longer relevant to, like, people in their early 20s.
For instance. Yeah. Although that's actually one of the few movies, again, that treats it like a non-issue.
That's true. Actually, yeah, that's a good point. Maybe that, you know, I never really loved that film, and I wonder if that's why, is that it just, maybe it was a little ahead of its time, or, like, it just felt like too much of a pipe dream that he would go to this town and everyone would be fine.
You know, I always thought of it as a, you know, be the change you wish to seek in the world, where a guy was like, I'm going to make a movie that is the world the way that I wish it would be, whether or not it's, you know, crushingly realistic, you know.
It was a Gilmore Girls gay movie.
Yes.
Your tiny little town where you are loved and fully enveloped in care.
Everyone's in each other's business, but in a very in a concerned, caring way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So no letters this week.
No
need for that. We do need your letters.
I know. And I know
we
I always
need you by us.
I always say to guide us. We definitely need to do like an all letter episode, because again, we've had so many guests
maybe
this month, and we have not been reading letters. Hey everybody, did you know we have a Patreon page?
Why don't you explain it very quickly?
If you want more of this, and why wouldn't you, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/linoleumknife, where we offer additional content like LKTV, a podcast of the television, Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics, and Linoleum Nights. That's the one where we talk about more taboo subject matter and, you know, drop the occasional F-bomb. There's also shirts. And
more than occasional.
Okay.
I like to say all the swears all the time.
Also, we got shirts and mugs and enamel pins and whatnot. We got custom-made personal podcasts. We got...
It's called Private Knife.
Yes.
We have one we have to get... we have to knock one out, like, today or tomorrow.
Okay.
For Jesse. Hello, Jesse.
We'll get on that. Also, like, hangouts and treats and prizes. Check it out.
Treats, prizes, hangouts.
Patreon.com.
Not in person.
No.
You're not coming over.
But virtually.
Yes.
On Google, that kind of hangout. Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
No one is coming over.
Matt Baum, you are a national treasure and always a delight to have around. Where can people find you online?
Well, I would encourage folks, if they are enjoying the Linoleum Knife family of products, they may enjoy Culture Cruise. That's my YouTube series where I talk about gay episodes of various TV shows, Deep Space Nine and Queer as Folk, and I'm working on one about Maud right now.
Nice. Did you? You know, I thought I had the Rock one on VHS somewhere, but I can't find it.
Oh, I did do the Rock episode.
Oh, good.
First that I could find the first same-sex commitment ceremony to be shown on American broadcast television.
Yes, and one of the grooms was played by Richard Roundtree.
Yes, yeah, nice. Incredibly. So I've got Culture Cruise on YouTube. You can find that by searching for Culture Cruise. And I've also got The Sewers of Paris, a podcast where I talk to queer people about the entertainment that has changed their lives. And if you would like some drag queens playing Dungeons & Dragons, it's basically, if that sounds weird, it's basically just, it's drag queens playing an improv game where they're on a fantasy adventure. So think Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, plus Lord of the Rings.
That's a hell of a pitch. Yes, so that's quite the elevator.
Queensofadventure.com for that show.
And you are on Twitter?
And I'm on Twitter. It's my name, at Matt Baume, MattBaume.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate you being here. We hope you have a fabulous drag con this weekend.
I look forward to it.
You know what we never talk about?
What do we never talk about?
We always forget to talk about
our feelings.
Yeah. What about mine? When are you going to start paying attention to my feelings?
God, I am soaking in your feelings 24/7.
What if you... Have you counted the ways in which you have hurt my feelings today? Because I've got a list. No, you know what we always forget to talk about?
What?
In the run-up to shutting down?
What's that?
We don't say, hey, go follow us on Instagram at LinoleumCast.
Oh.
Or go follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast.
I do say that, actually, as part of...
Do you?
By this
do
point,
you say go follow you at A. Duralde at Twitter?
I don't.
Do you say go follow D. Leland White at Twitter or Instagram?
I have not been.
Maybe you ought to should.
Yes.
Maybe we ought to start trying to remember that
all
stuff.
Right. Well, I do always include Linoleum Cast. By this point, you have taken off your headphones and are no longer listening to me.
Right.
But I always say, follow us at Linoleum Cast. Follow us at Linoleum Cast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. It is a thing I say. Yes, check out our friends on the internet. I always mention Sewers of Paris.
I'm like that dog in The Far Side where it's all blah, 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 ginger.
Ginger, yes. And apparently so. Check out Cancel Too Soon and The Schmoes Know and Dennis N. With Dennis Hensley and All Things Cozy and the Comics Canon and Fat Guys of the Movies and Criterion Cast and Secretly Timid. You can please subscribe for free and leave us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts. You can also leave positive reviews in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, and Spotify, and Google Play, and Castbox, and Podbean. Again, at Linoleum Cast on all the things. I'm at A. Duralde, A-D-U-R-A-L-D-E on Twitter. You're at D. Leland White on Twitter and Instagram. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. He is at Bluetopia.com, B-L-E-U-T-O-P-I-A. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We will be accepting your boom essays until 11:59 p.m. May 31st Pacific Daylight Time.
Yeah.
So, hey, thanks for listening. Thanks for being here, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
And until next time.
I'm going to wait for this garbage truck to keep rolling on out before I say anything, because
you don't want to cut him off abruptly.
I listen.
Give him an opportunity to.
I feel like he's taken up my microphone time. Oh, he stopped. Okay. Goodbye.